Rachel Grimm, and welcome to the podcast With All Your Mind. I'm here to help us understand the Bible with cultural and historical context, linguistic info, and other cool stuff. Enjoy. All right, guys, fifth time is the charm. Welcome back. This is Rachel, and this is With All Your Mind, and this is the fifth time I'm trying to record this podcast. I'm making these really silly little mistakes, and I'm hoping this is the last time I have to do this. Okay. Hey, how are you? How's your day going? I hope it's going a little bit smoother than my weird little afternoon. The rest of the day has been fine. You don't have to feel bad for me or anything. Everything is fine here. I'm just having a weird moment. So, okay, this episode 7 of our little season 3, our little itty bitty baby season 3, is about more Greek stuff. And I know I focused a lot on Hebrew and the Old Testament in this season, and only the last episode in this one on the Greek. And it's because I love Hebrew, and there's a lot more that I can say about Hebrew. But I forgot how fun Greek can be and the New Testament, because it's so much easier. Like, it's just more straightforward and we have more resources. I've talked about this, right? But it just feels easier. Basically, have fun with this one, because this one you do not have to think so hard. So it's kind of like brain candy where you can just gobble it up and have fun, and it's nice. Okay, so that's what this is. And yeah, I already said this once when I tried to record this before, but I'll tell you again. It's fine. And I realized in like episode 2 or 3 of this season, I started a story and I never finished it. And you might not have recognized that there was more to the story, but it's been bothering me so much. And I have to tell you what this story is, okay? So back in episode 2 or 3, I was talking about socio and psycholinguistics. Do you remember this? And there was a professor in college, a linguistics professor, that was explaining these two branches of linguistics to my class. And I kind of laughed when I was starting to talk about this. And it's because I will never forget how, when she was introducing these concepts, she said that psycholinguistics and sociolinguistics take themselves so seriously and disagree so harshly with each other that they were one time like a bunch of professors at a conference, and then a legit riot broke out in between these professors over, yeah, how to think about linguistics. And I tried to Google it to see like what was she specifically talking about, and I couldn't really find a whole lot. So I don't know what conference it was or even like which decade it was in. I graduated from college in 2005, so it was before that. But was this the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s? I don't know. So anyway, I just needed to finish that story. I don't really honestly care too much if you care about it, but I needed to finish the story. So let's get to our Greek and New Testament stuff. We're not even focusing too much on Greek today, mostly just focusing on New Testament features that will give us more information on the world of the New Testament, where the Bible is set, and will just help us to kind of imagine that world better. And we're going to start off with the Septuagint, which I mentioned in the last episode. I kind of just like mentioned it and then dropped it again. It's because I couldn't really get into it because I wanted to get into it today. It's a big deal. And if you don't know too much about it, you can go to, I have an episode for that. Yeah, there's an episode for that. Season 2, episode 7. I talk a lot more about the Septuagint. So go there if you want more information about the Septuagint. I'm just going to briefly touch on some of those things and then we'll go on. So just some general information. The Septuagint is from a Latin word for 70, and it is a general term. It's not like a specific document. You can't hold up a book and say, here's the Septuagint. No, it is the collection of the Greek version of the Old Testament, done by Hebrew scholars starting in about the 200s BC. There's different legends about it and different stories. It got its name, Septuagint, because one of those legends is that there were 70 Hebrew scholars that were invited to Egypt to basically translate the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek. There was a big Greek-speaking population of Jews in Egypt. There's lots of archaeological records for this. You can look it up. Egypt was controlled by the Greeks at this time. Okay? So that was part of the reason, but there was also the Library of Alexandria, and another reason was that they wanted a copy of the Hebrew Old Testament for the Library of Alexandria. We don't know exactly, you know, we don't have exact records for these things, like what was first, who wanted it first, who actually wrote it. But one of the legends was that they invited 70 Hebrew scholars to come to Egypt to write this translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. And the legend, like the most extreme version of the legend, is that they took the scholars and split them up and put them on islands in the Nile Delta and had them write out basically the Torah, the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. And then we brought them back together to compare their translations, and they were word for word exact. And so there was just a lot of, there's a lot of stories and legend. It has basically legendary status, the Septuagint. A lot of people at the time believed it was divinely inspired, just as the Hebrew Old Testament was. People today still have that belief. It has a very special place in terms of translations of the Bible and the Bible itself. It's kind of its own little special creature, and it still plays a huge role in Christian interpretation of the Old Testament to this day. It's a big deal. It's a really big deal, and we'll get into that a little bit more later. So basically, when the Septuagint was first written, it was probably just the first five books of the Bible that were translated into Greek in the 200s BC. And then it was slowly added onto, and the whole Hebrew Old Testament completed before Jesus was born. It was definitely done before Jesus was born. And we don't know many more specifics about it, but here's the cool part. We still do have manuscripts from that time period, direct evidence, which is so cool, of the Greek version, the Greek translation of the Old Testament from before the time of Jesus. So why mention this at all, though? We know it's important for now, just because I said so. But what does it matter? It does matter for cultural influences on the New Testament, because it was written before the New Testament was written. And we know that Jesus and the New Testament authors quoted from the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament, perhaps along with, or maybe instead of, the original Hebrew version. How do we know that? Well, if you've ever read a New Testament quote of the Old Testament and thought, I don't remember it being quite that way, you're right. You're right. Now, there's two reasons for that. Number one, sometimes New Testament writers paraphrased just a tiny bit. Sometimes they only quoted part of a passage and then put it together with a different passage. But the third option for that is that they could have been quoting from the Greek Old Testament rather than the Hebrew Old Testament. So I have some examples here. In Hebrews 11, the author says, "By faith Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff." Okay, it's not a terribly well-known passage, but we know that chapter. It's the by faith chapter. And that is a partial quote from Genesis 47:31. But there, it says different things based on, here's the trick, which version of the Bible you're reading. In lots of versions, most of the versions, it says that Joseph worshipped or bowed himself on the head of his bed, not on his staff. In the NIV and the Septuagint, it says that he worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff, not on the bed. So it's not a big difference, right? We get it. Jacob was old and leaning on something, and he worshipped. But the difference is that the Septuagint says that he was on his staff. The Masoretic, the Hebrew Old Testament, says that he worshipped on the head of his bed. He was leaning on something. But there's a discrepancy. A difference on, was it the bed or his staff. But the NIV, for some reason, decided to say, I think the Septuagint is right. We're going to stick with what the Septuagint says. So it does influence your English Bible, even if the original Hebrew said something different. There are other passages that seem to line up with the Septuagint better than the Hebrew text, such as, I'm just going to give you some examples. We're not going to go through them. It's just for you to look up later if you want. Mark 7, 6 through 7, Matthew 21, 16, and many other places. But like everything with the Bible, I'm sorry, not sorry, but sorry, there's debate about this. It's not 100% sure if people were really quoting from the Septuagint. Why is there debate? Well, probably in part is because the Septuagint includes the Apocrypha. Those would be the, what we would also call the deuterocanonical books of the Old Testament. Those are the books that are accepted by the Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church, but not by the Protestant Church. And so Protestants can be prone to push back on anything that uses the Septuagint, that seems to defend it and kind of honor it or give it a place of precedence over the Hebrew text. And Catholics and other denominations can prefer versions that support the Septuagint or accept more of its influence or potential influence. So it's partly Bible politics. Either way, the Septuagint was definitely used regularly and often by Christians and definitely by Greek-speaking Jews of the first century. It was not seen as a bad or weird thing. And we'll talk about what it would mean if Jesus used it in the next episode. Not going to go too much further into it. Oh, but one other thing I wanted to mention is I was just listening to a podcast episode 3 days ago. And it was by this professor, I forget his name. He was doing this project of reading through the Septuagint in a year, kind of like a Bible reading plan of reading through the Septuagint in a year. He was on his second year of doing that. And the guy that was interviewing him was asking, you know, like, what difference did this make to you? Like, what did it do to read the Septuagint? Did you get better at reading Greek? Blah, blah, blah. What happened? And he's like, oh, yeah, like my reading comprehension, you know, got so much better. But another thing that he mentioned, and I was really surprised at this, he mentioned that when he came across more rare words in the Septuagint, say, and I forget his example, so I'm just going to make something up. Say he saw a word that meant to wash, but it was like a weird one that he'd never seen before. He would look it up. And he started to see where in the New Testament, somebody had used the same word. Oh, I'm starting to remember the story. Hold on. Ah, yeah, I even used this word this week. It was the story with Achan when they were going into the Promised Land. And there was the story of Jericho and Ai and how everything in Ai was supposed to be destroyed, right? But Achan stole something. And the proclamation was, everything is dedicated to God, and Achan stole it, which means he took it, but was it really stealing? It was a kind of stealing, right? I mean, they were coming in and destroying everything. Is it stealing to take something that's not just, you know, should be destroyed? It's kind of a weird stealing. Well, this guy was reading that story, and he looked up that word for steal, and he said that the English word was more like purloin. And I don't know the word purloin very much. But then he realized it was also in the New Testament. The story that used the same word in the New Testament was out of Acts 5. And it's Ananias and Sapphira who sell their property. And they wanted to donate the money to the church. But they came up and they told the apostles, here's all the money for the property that we sold. And they were lying. And they held something back that they weren't supposed to help hold back or be honest about it. And the guy said that he realized that there was a parallel between Achan and Ai and the new church and Ananias and Sapphira. That basically God was doing a new thing, going into a new place with a new plan. And these people were being deceptive with what they were doing in this new environment. And it was this one word for steal that triggered this idea for him. So I had never thought of the idea that perhaps New Testament writers were using words or phrases from the Septuagint in order to trigger the minds of the readers, but that's a definite possibility. It does not mean that we can look at it every time and say, oh, well, Luke used this word to make us think of this passage from the Old Testament. That's way too much going on. But it's a definite possibility, and I'm not the expert to show you any of those things, but I thought that was a very interesting, a little bit more of a thin ice idea that you wouldn't want to rely on a whole lot. But I realized, no, that's a really good one, because the topics alone in those two stories should make us think about each of them, right? It was really interesting. So the Septuagint can be used in lots of different ways, you guys. All right, so another cool thing we see in the New Testament is the quotation of books and literary figures outside of the Bible, not just a translation of the Bible, but completely different books. In the same way that any modern book might quote from Shakespeare or Jane Austen or Mark Twain, biblical authors also quoted from other books and other people. We see this and we barely think anything of it when we don't know the book, such as in the Old Testament, it says that things were written in the book of Jasher or in the book of the Wars of the Lord. We don't even think anything about that. So we know there were other books, and they weren't seen as bad or unnecessary. And the same thing goes for the New Testament. In the New Testament, we know that the book of Enoch is mentioned and quoted in the book of Jude. Another of Paul's letters to the Corinthians is mentioned in 1 Corinthians. So I know some people, when they're talking about 1 Corinthians, they don't call it 1 Corinthians, they call it 1 Corinthians. And it's because it's not the first book that was written to the Corinthians. It's not the first. You can't call it the first. We don't even know if it was the second. There might have been other letters. We just don't have the first letter. So those are still biblically related books and ideas, things about the Jewish people or about the history of Israel. However, we also know that Paul and others quote and reference Gentile authors. A great and really easy to see example of this is in Titus 1. Where Paul quotes what we believe to be Epimenides. So here's the quote. Paul says, "One of Crete's own prophets has said it. Cretans are always liars, evil brutes, lazy gluttons. This saying is true. Therefore, rebuke them sharply so that they will be sound in the faith." So Paul is basically quoting this non-Christian author to prove his point that everyone can see how messed up this particular group of people is. And this guy, Epimenides, was a somewhat legendary figure. He lived about 500 years before Paul. He was a prophet. He's kind of like Aesop in Shakespeare, that he definitely wrote a lot, but we don't know exactly what, and things may have been attributed to him that weren't really written by him. And he is quoted, by the way, in other places in the New Testament, including in Acts. But he wasn't a Christian. He wasn't Jewish. He was a Greek pagan. And yet Paul feels free to mention him to prove a point. I like that. I like that we don't need to shun even the mention of non-believers, as if mentioning them taints us with their thoughts or their beliefs. All right, so we're moving on now to something to do with format. And this is a pretty simple one, but I thought it was pretty worthwhile to mention. And again, a lot of this I learned from one of my study Bibles. I tell you guys why it is worth it to get a good study Bible. And if you need one and you don't mind it being massive, and there usually are, I really recommend the NIV Archaeological Study Bible. You can find it on Amazon. It's just so good. It's easy to read. It has some pictures. And it just gives you these nice, concise articles that just, they just help so much. I really like them. But yeah. Lots of letters have been found from Greco-Roman times, and we use that term to mean between 800 BC and 500 AD, so it's a huge span of time. But we have letters that have been found on clay tablets, parchment, papyrus, broken pieces of pottery called ostracon, because if you broke a pot, that basically became your scratch paper, and other things. And they had the Greek and Roman systems had kind of like a Pony Express system, where they had set relay stations where they kept riders and horses and like an inn and a restaurant, basically, you know, not fancy. But still, they had relay stations for messengers. And so they had a much better letter system, message system than a lot of other places did. So some examples, letters have been found by Cicero, Pliny the Younger, if you've ever heard of him. And those are from within 100 years before Jesus. And there's also a big collection of letters from the 14th century BC called the Amarna letters. And those are pretty important for archaeology. Those ones are written between both Egyptian and Mesopotamian leaders to each other. And they're on clay tablets and written in cuneiform. So basically all this to say, we know a few things about ancient letter writing. We know the delivery system, who used to write letters, why and how. And something that we can say is that Greco-Roman letters had a pretty standard format. Here's the format. See if you can recognize it. There's number one, an introduction saying who the writer was, who it was to, and greetings. Number two, a thanks be to blah blah. Basically, whoever it was appropriate to thank. And then the main body of the letter. And then number three, a conclusion would have wishes for good health and a closing farewell. And the closings could get pretty long. Okay. Now, does it seem like I basically just described for you all of the epistles of Paul? Yeah, because Paul used that standard Greco-Roman letter writing format. And he adopted that style, or simply kept using it. Maybe he already used that letter writing style, but he adapted it in a few ways. Number one, he changed the greeting from simply greetings, that's what it was, greetings, which in Greek was kyrene. And he changed it just a little bit, kyrene, which means greetings. He changed it to charis, which means grace. So he took something that was familiar and he changed it to something that wasn't weird, but it was very fitting for Christianity. And last, he often included prayers to God in with the thanksgiving part. And obviously he had very, very long closings at times. So isn't it nice to know that Paul's letters would have made sense to his audience, the churches of the ancient world? The Bible in its world wasn't supposed to be so crazy and foreign that nobody could understand any of it. And speaking of understanding things, here's my last one for today. I read something in that archaeological Bible that really changed a mental movie that I had about a story in Acts. The article in the study Bible was about different types of housing in the New Testament. And we know a lot from archaeology, but I can also tell you a bit from personal experience from living in Israel. Most of what you see from ancient times is things that were built by the government, things that were built by groups of people, and things that were built for royalty. So things like city walls and aqueducts and fortresses and temples and synagogues and palaces. Those are the things that you usually see because those are the things that had a lot of resources put behind them and they were built well and they lasted, right? So one example that I could think of is in Caesarea, which is on the beach, basically, in northern Israel. You can still climb on these aqueducts, where it was just like a huge wall, basically, with arches in it. And it's really cool because you can just climb all over it. Like, it's still there. Not the whole thing, but stretches of it, you know, a mile or so at a time. It's all over Europe and the Middle East in stretches because these things just lasted. Another one that we went to was the fortress called Masada, and it was Herod's desert fortress, and it's down by the Dead Sea. And it's built up on this plateau, basically, like a pillar of rock, basically, a huge one, like a mesa. And it's within sight of the Dead Sea, so that when you're up on top of it, you can look out over the Dead Sea, and it's beautiful. It's gorgeous. And you can basically choose to either hike up to it or take a cable car up to it. That's the two ways to get up there. And there's a really fancy restaurant down at the bottom in the tourism center and all that. So being me, I forced Ryan and I to do the hike up to it. And I think it took about an hour or so. So we had to get a head start on the rest of our group. And they were already up there doing their tour. And we're just, you know, huffing and puffing up there. And it's just, you know, switchback after switchback up this sandy, rocky hill. And you get to the top and it's just this huge plateau inside a wall because it's a fortress. And it feels like you need a golf cart to get around up there because it's just remnants of buildings all over the place. And this place was fancy, all right? There were cisterns, there was a swimming pool, there were several palaces, you know, there was barracks, all sorts of stuff. It was huge. And that was Herod's fortress. There are different places that had some mosaics on the floors. It was beautiful. So from archaeology, you often get pictures of the general, the royal, the massive, the well-built, because those are the things that last. So it's very interesting to hear how the poorer people lived, the lower classes. And there's not very many stories and examples of their things because they didn't last. They weren't built out of solid stone. So here's a story that I didn't realize was about a lower class building. Ready? This is Acts 20, 7 through 12. On the first day of the week, we came together to break bread. Paul spoke to the people, and because he intended to leave the next day, kept on talking until midnight. There were many lamps in the upstairs room where we were meeting. Seated in a window was a young man named Eutychus, who was sinking into a deep sleep as Paul talked on and on. When he was sound asleep, he fell to the ground from the third story and was picked up dead. Paul went down, threw himself on the young man, and put his arms around him. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "He's alive." Then he went upstairs again and broke bread and ate. After talking until daylight, he left. So it's a story from one of Paul's missionary journeys. And this happens in Troas. We learn from the story it's Troas, which is a port city in northwestern Turkey, or what it is called in the Bible, Asia Minor. And all that we are really told about the location is that this guy was in the window of a third floor building. And I don't know why. And well, I know why now. I do know why. Because I only knew about these fancier, bigger buildings, I imagined that this guy was in a fancy, big house. Maybe not quite, you know, palace, but a big building, a nice building with pillars and the window he was sitting on. This is how I imagined it. I imagined that he was sitting on a big wide windowsill with maybe a terrace outside and, you know, just kind of Mediterranean feeling. You know, those pictures you have of Greece when you're up above a town and it's all white and blue and there's the ocean. I think that's how I was imagining this. And so I guess I imagined people just kind of leisurely laying around. And so, yeah, I was thinking of upper class, nicer, not working class. Then I read in my archaeological study Bible that if it was a three-story building, it was probably what was called an insulae, I-N-S-U-L-A-E, insulae, an ancient apartment building. There would be stairs on the outside, and so this was a standard kind of building, and I'll describe what the article said about it. There would be stairs on the outside, and it would have no heating, no plumbing, and no sewage, you know, way of dealing with sewage. And it would be a very crowded building where each room would have a family. And it would be lower class people that lived here. It was basically urban ghetto of the Roman Empire. And so when I was thinking about what would this look like to me now with this information, I thought about the book Crime and Punishment. And this is a book by Dostoevsky. And if you've ever read it, it's this really horrible picture of humanity. It like portrays misery in this book. Everybody is sick. People don't necessarily have doors. They have like a curtain for a door, and families are just packed into these little rooms in the horrible apartment buildings, and there's loan sharks everywhere. And it's just horrible, like depressing. Like, yeah, it's a really depressing book. And so I thought about that. And then I was in Russia in, I think it was 2003. And where I stayed was a hotel. And they were treating it like as a dorm for my group that was there. And it was Soviet style, though. Like, for them, it was pretty nice, but it was just bare concrete floors, bare concrete walls. And I was there in the summer, so it was fine. But I would not want to be there in the wintertime. And I was just thinking, like, that's what this feels like to me now. It does not feel like a Mediterranean villa anymore. It feels like a Russian Soviet apartment building. So Paul was not teaching in some really nice house that had lots of floors. He was teaching in the ghetto or Soviet apartments, however you want to think about it. Like we mentioned in the last episode about the triclinium, how that's upper class. Now we're getting the other side of the lower class. Paul wasn't afraid to get into what did this look like? People crammed in? Was it really hot, especially with all those lamps up there? And the kid was just trying to get to some fresh air. And, you know, disease runs wild in places like that because you can't clean up so well. People are so close to each other. It's easy to get things like lice and bed bugs. So you imagine Paul now in this room with people that might have lice or bed bugs or pneumonia. Because I'm thinking of Dostoevsky probably and Crime and Punishment. But it's like, this is not the picture of the Last Supper in an upper room, basically having dinner in a nice calm setting. This is in a poor apartment that is not necessarily comfortable. And I looked up Troas at this time, and it was possibly a city of about 100,000 people. So it's not some little town that had like one apartment building. So all of these ideas, they're a little bit off the beaten path with the other things we've been talking about that were more linguistic focused, more about the effect of language on what we're reading. This is more about the culture, the environment around the New Testament. But I thought it was just too interesting not to share. So up next, in our last normal episode for the season, unless you guys want to do a Q&A, and I'm going to close it now. This is the last day that you can throw anything at me that you want. Up next, though, what does this mean for our perception of Jesus? Does this change anything for what it means that Jesus ate at a triclinium, that Paul taught in the ghetto, that biblical Hebrew does not have a word for yes? What does this mean about Jesus? Okay, so come back next week. I promise you it'll be worth it. Really good stuff. Okay, so I look forward to it with you guys. I hope you have a great day, and I'll talk to you later. Bye.